It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the program, we have a lot of very interesting conversations this hour. Short conversations, as we like to do on our News Buzz Fridays. Later, we'll be talking with Betty Andrews of the NAACP to give her perspective on the data you heard, I'm sure, in IPR News this week, how Black and Hispanic Iowans are disproportionately testing positive for the COVID-19 disease. Later in the hour, my conversation with 100-year-old former Congressman Neil Smith, how he's coping with isolation at his retirement home, what he thinks of this crisis. Also later in the hour, and this is a breathtaking interview that I have to say was something to conduct. I spoke with this man in Cedar Rapids yesterday. He spent 2 weeks in the hospital with COVID-19 in the ICU, on a ventilator, also in an induced coma. He's thankfully been released earlier this week. A conversation with Larry Potter of Cedar Rapids in the second half hour of our program. But first, let's start off with an update from our IPR health reporter, Natalie Krebs. Hi, Natalie.
Hey, Ben.
I know there's been some movement on the news. The governor has been speaking within the last few minutes. What's new from the governor?
Right. So the biggest thing that the governor just announced today is that Iowa schools will not reopen for the rest of the school year. She says continuous learning plans are put in place, but basically schools will not come back in May as originally was sort of potentially scheduled.
Mm-hmm. Did she say what triggered that or any other details on that aspect?
She basically just said that they've looked it over. They think it's not safe to open schools in May, so they're going to be out for the rest of the school year. You know, schools have had to implement continuous learning plans. Those are required to be submitted by, you know, the middle of the month. Mm-hmm. Those will be put in place. Schools will also need to submit a return to learn plan. So basically they have to tell the state how they're going to sort of open up next August. And she also waived the late August start date so schools can start next fall when they feel is most appropriate.
Okay. Governor Kim Reynolds saying schools will remain closed as a physical location for the rest of the year. Let's talk about the governor's let's talk about the latest numbers. What do we have there in terms of infections and deaths in the state, Natalie?
Yeah, so the governor today announced 191 new confirmed cases of COVID-19. That brings the state's total to 2,332 cases. Four additional deaths have been reported. That's bringing the state's total to 64 deaths. We have 183 that are hospitalized, 52 on ventilators, 88 in the ICU. And then she's also noted, too, a lot of the positive cases have been in long-term care facilities. 13% of the confirmed positive cases are in LTCs. And then 45% of the deaths have been in long-term care facilities.
Mm-hmm. Nearly half. That's a statistic we want to keep in mind. Let's talk about what the governor announced and the action she announced yesterday that pertains to Northeast Iowa. I mean, this is more than a dozen counties in the northeastern part of the state, right?
Right. So Governor Reynolds announced yesterday that she is implementing kind of a partial shutdown in 14 counties in Northeast Iowa. The state has, you know, sort of divided the state into six regions and has been assessing each region based on a 12-point system. That's percentage of the population that's over 65, percentage of identified cases requiring hospitalization, infection rate, and then outbreaks at long-term care facilities. And, the region needed a 10 out of 12 to implement this partial shutdown. And basically what that means is that residents in these 14 counties will be limited to just activities in their household, and they, you know, really only leaving the house for essential needs. And the only exception will be weddings, funerals, and then religious ceremonies, and that's still limited to just 10 people.
Okay, so those, I think, 14 counties in Northeast Iowa. But in announcing this, it was interesting because it's become part of the national conversation that Iowa is one of a handful of states that has not had its governor issue a statewide shelter-in-place order. Did the governor say that phrase, shelter-in-place, though it seems to add up to that or close to that, right?
Right. No, this is still not a shelter in place order. This is just additional restrictions on this particular part of Iowa. Iowa is still under no shelter in place order. The governor has said the reason she hasn't done this is because she's issued so many restrictions so far, shutting down restaurants and schools, telling people to stay home. That is unnecessary to implement this, you know, shelter in place order. So basically what she announced yesterday was just additional restrictions in Northeast Iowa.
Right. And at that same time this week, she's been announcing a phased reopening, right? So according to data, she says?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the governor today said that, you know, her phased reopening program looks a lot like President Trump's, which, you know, it comes in three phases. But, you know, she hasn't really announced when that's going to happen. You know, phase two is when schools can reopen, when people can gather to more than, you know, 50 people to up to 50 people. And, you know, today she's saying that schools will need to be closed for the rest of the school year. So, you know, she said her plan is close to what President Trump has said, but we're not sure when that's actually going to be implemented.
And it's interesting when we talk about the phased reopening or closing or whatever needs to be done in the future. There is, as of this week, a coalition of Midwestern states fighting the COVID crisis together, but Iowa not included?
Right. So yesterday, a coalition of seven Midwestern states announced they're going to work together to figure out how to reopen the economy as a region. And this is something that we've seen in eastern states and western states, but Iowa was not on that list. Asked about that today at the press conference, Governor Reynolds says she has a good working relationship with the governors in, you know, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, Missouri. These actually are the other Midwestern states that are not in that coalition as well. But she said she's been working with those states. And then she said that she has worked with the Illinois governor in the past, but she didn't really specify if she is working with him now currently on reopening the economy. So, yeah, I was not part of that collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some hot spots in Iowa. Otherwise, Loisa County in southeast Iowa. What can you tell us about that? The virus is spreading faster there than, wow, statistically very fast, right?
Right. Loisa County is the site of a Tyson pork processing facility, which has had about 200 confirmed COVID-19 cases so far, two deaths. That's just what we know of. So it's been rapidly spreading through that county. Is one of the few counties across the state that doesn't have a hospital. And so the governor also has been sort of addressing concerns about pork processing facilities. She's saying she's been in contact with a lot of the pork processing or food processing facilities like this across the state. The state has 18 of them to implement sort of stricter, you know, protective measures, although it's kind of unclear how the state's going to enforce this.
Mm-hmm. A lot of aspects you're covering. Thank you for the update, Natalie. Did we leave anything out? Anything to mention quickly as before we leave?
I think we're good so far. Okay. I think that's about the biggest update. So, yeah, thank you, Ben.
We are running to keep up to speed on the updates, and we're so glad to have Natalie Krebs, our Iowa Public Radio health reporter, keeping her eye on this and covering and doing interviews and talking. Natalie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the new Department of Public Health data in the state shows that Black and Hispanic Iowans are disproportionately testing positive for this disease, COVID-19. Let's get a perspective about what's behind this disparity by talking with Betty Andrews, State Area President of Iowa-Nebraska NAACP Conference of Branches. Betty, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks so much for having me you, Ben.
Thank you. Let me just sort of summarize and make sure we're on the same page before I ask you for your perspective here. According to this new data, while Hispanic and Latino Iowans make up about just over 6% of the state's population, they account for over 16% of the positive tests for COVID. Black Iowans are about 4% of the state's population, but almost 9% of the total confirmed cases. And let's go to white Iowans, Caucasians, about over 90% of the state's population, Caucasian, the Census Bureau says, but white Iowans only 73% of confirmed COVID-19 cases. Now, the state government had previously declined to release data on the racial makeup of those who had been sickened. I hope that summary is in accord with what you have there, Betty. What can you tell us about the release of this new data this week?
Sure, Ben. So actually, I just checked in on those numbers, and it's actually a little higher. Latinos are right at 18%, and the African-American community is over 9%. So we're talking rates of 2 to 3 times that of our white neighbors. And so it is definitely a challenge. I know that last week we issued a call to the governor to release this data because we had been hearing emerging information about from the NAACP units all across the country as to how COVID-19 was ripping through the community, not only in positive testing, but also in actually death rates. And so we are grateful that the governor responded and produced this information. It is really key at looking at this. I think demographics and the pathology of any disease is extremely important. That's how you track it. That's how you gather information on how to fight it, et cetera. And it's also going to be helpful for future crises. So for us, these numbers are not necessarily what I would call shocking because we deal with disparities with regards to race and ethnicity all the time. But they certainly are disturbing.
Okay.
Many regards.
In the limited time we have, let me just have you explain this, because in the letter, I saw the letter you wrote to Governor Reynolds. You quoted a common saying in African-American communities, when America sneezes, the black community catches pneumonia. What is behind this disparity? Why is that?
So there are a number of factors that are behind this disparity. I know that a lot of times we've been talking about the underlying risk factors that already exist. And this is kind of why we in the advocacy community stress in times where we're not at this type of crisis that these disparities represent a crisis for communities of color. So when you talk about health, you know, a lot of times people go, well, heart disease and things like asthma and diabetes and things like that. And they list a number of factors. And mind you, some of those diseases are lifestyle diseases, but also some of those are diseases that have to do with lack of resources. And then when you think about sickle cell anemia and as well as asthma, those are not lifestyle diseases. So these are risk factors that are prevalent in communities of color, and there are also environmental issues as well. So the lack of resources often ends up being amounting to higher risk factors.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, what is the NAACP calling for in terms of action? Specifically, let's talk about specifically the state of Iowa, this area. What action did you recommend to the governor?
Sure. So first and foremost, we think the governor did come through in terms of making sure that these numbers were announced and this information was available electronically so that the public could have access. Now we need the governor to make sure that we take the next step and announce the testing rates, the with regard to race and ethnicity, as well as the death rates. These are critical because we have certainly received anecdotal reports that people have had challenges when it comes to testing, and I say people of color, and of course with people of color often and immigrants often being the essential workers, which we're seeing in the meatpacking plants across the state. It is critical that we make sure that these communities have access to testing.
Mm-hmm. Is there any resistance? Have you encountered any resistance, or what kind of to releasing the ethnic data when it comes to the categories you mentioned?
Well, I'm not going to say that we are receiving resistance, other than we have not seen those numbers yet. And I know that I've heard members of the media ask that question at the governor's press conference, and they were told that they're not announcing those at this time. So mm-hmm. We will continue to press for getting those announced.
I saw in your letter to the governor, you are also offering assistance. In what form?
Sure. So what we would like to see, because it's important to monitor and to report, but it's also important to view this through the lens of disparate impact. And so one of the things the NAACP would like to offer is to convene a panel of diverse voices and be a part of that conversation so that it is considered. So when you are looking at disparities, they have to be a part of the conversation. And so being able to bring that to fruition is important. Also thinking about communication in terms of making sure all of the information is in all of the necessary languages, and making sure that we're penetrating in terms of utilizing diverse media organizations that go deep into each of those communities, like the NAACP or LULAC or the African American or Latino radio stations, utilizing those avenues in terms of making sure the information is distributed. And then also the NAACP has been very strong on emphasizing to the African American community and communities of color. There are some rumors going around that African Americans are less susceptible to this illness, and that is absolutely not true, but that was an early rumor that we have had to constantly dispel. And if we don't dispel rumors like that people tend to put themselves at higher risk.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, Betty, anything specifically to the Latinx community, Latinos?
Sure. So as we've seen, those numbers are right at about three times the risk. And so I have been speaking with our brothers at LULAC, and we are there working together, and I'm just trying to make sure that there is access, that information is provided in everyone's language, and just ensure that we are reaching all vulnerable populations.
Okay. And just to sum up, what I'm hearing from you, if this is correct, is you've been pushing for this type of information about ethnic data on how this virus is connecting and impacting various ethnic groups. You're happy with what you have so far, but you want more.
We are pleased that those numbers have been released as to where they are right now, but we are definitely interested in more.
Okay. Betty Andrews, State Area President, Iowa-Nebraska NAACP Conference of Branches. Betty, always good to talk to you. We'll check in with you again for a future update.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's now zoom in on one Iowa county, Blackhawk County, with Iowa Public Radio's All Things Considered host and reporter Pat Blank. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Ben.
So tell us a little bit more about what's been happening, news in Blackhawk County. A spike.
A spike, indeed. The Blackhawk County Sheriff yesterday pointed out during a news briefing and in a conversation with me that Blackhawk County 2 weeks ago had only 8 confirmed cases of coronavirus. Yesterday, that number jumped to 150. And today, an additional 29 have been reported.
Mm, okay. And you've been talking to some people, the sheriff, right? Tony Thompson there?
Yes. And he's coordinating the emergency management office here.
Okay. Let's listen to a little bit of Sheriff Tony Thompson of Blackhawk County. And I believe this is some tape that you gathered, Pat. I have here in my notes, this is what he saw when visiting the Tyson plant in question.
And the things that we saw from a prevention and safety protective measure perspective was not where we wanted it to be then. They have since tightened it up even more, but I'm afraid it may have been just a little too late at that point. And so now we're working on that very very difficult position of being reactionary to an outbreak spread based on some pretty loose standards that we're going to pay for.
Mm. Sheriff Tony Thompson there. Elaborate, Pat Blank, on what Tony Thompson told you.
Well, he said the situation is very frustrating on many levels because at the same time these cases are spiking. He also is in charge of procuring PPE, personal protective equipment, and he's been unable to get that. So now there's another fear that now that these cases are coming in and more are being reported and possibly more people being hospitalized, that he won't be able to get the equipment that he needs for the healthcare providers.
Right, and help us understand, and I know we had it in the national NPR news, Georgia meatpacking plants, a real problem area for the same reason. What is going on? Why meatpacking plants across the country and here in Iowa?
Well, and part of it is that people can't do social distancing. You can't work 6 feet apart and pack meat. You have to be side by side. And all it takes is, you know, one or two people who are either infected or are just carrying coronavirus to have it spread very rapidly, and that's the main problem right there.
And also, these are some of our lowest paid workers, right? And they if they don't go to work, they don't get paid. Is that part
exactly.
of it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay.
And meatpacking is still an essential business. So even though these cases have been reported, Tyson in Waterloo is open today.
Mm. Okay. Anything to add? We have a few seconds left. Pat Blank?
Sheriff Tony Thompson did hint yesterday that during the news briefing today that perhaps State Senator Bill Dotzler and a couple of other officials would be pressing the governor to temporarily shut down Tyson and Waterloo.
Okay. Thank you, Pat Blank, for that update of specifically Blackhawk County. We appreciate it, Pat. We'll listen for you this afternoon on All Things Considered.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, you'll want to stay tuned to listen to this. A conversation I had recently with Larry Potter from Cedar Rapids. He's 65 years old, and he was just released from 2 weeks in urgent care at the Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. An amazing story he has to tell of how he was admitted to the hospital, to the ICU, on the ventilator, also an induced coma, which helped him survive. Larry Potter of Cedar Rapids, a survivor of COVID-19. After we take a short break, it's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's hear from an Iowan who has just this week been released from 2 weeks in urgent care due to the virus. Larry Potter is 65 years old from Cedar Rapids. He survived COVID-19, the disease, the respiratory disease caused by the new coronavirus. Larry Potter, welcome. And from the bottom of my heart, I am so glad that you could join us.
Hi, Ben. It's great to be here.
You were released from Mercy Medical Center on Monday?
Yes. I was released Monday, the day after Easter.
And what was that like?
Well, they do a fine job there. It's a wonderful place. I was admitted on the 29th into the ICU. Spent 9 days there, two on a ventilator, and then 6 days in rehab.
Let's have you take us back to when you first detected the first symptoms. What did you first notice, and when?
Well, on March 20th, I started feeling sick. had a fever, difficulty breathing. All the basic symptoms. And, you know, one that I'm not sure that a lot of people know about, you lose or at least I did, I lost the sense of smell and taste.
I've heard about that, yes. You quickly noticed that was gone.
I did notice that. It was dramatic because it wasn't just faded, it was gone. So on the 24th, we FaceTimed our personal doctor. But one thing we didn't know, the thermometer we had at home didn't work.
Oh, no.
So he said, I know. He says, my gosh, you've got all the symptoms except the fever. And I said, I know. And we went on another day or two, and then I was shivering at night, couldn't get enough covers. I told my wife, I said, I think maybe our thermometer's broken. So she found one. Luckily, they're probably not that easy to find. She found one at Hy-Vee, and sure enough, it was 102.
Oh, my goodness.
So then my doctor sent me to Mercy Medical Center. On the 26th, they diagnosed me with pneumonia and gave me the COVID test, which, thank God for that. They're very difficult to get, but they did give me one.
Mm-hmm. Take us from your arrival at the Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids to how you arrived on a ventilator. How did your symptoms progress?
Well, I was admitted on the 29th in the late afternoon, early evening. They did a chest x-ray first thing and sent me directly to ICU. I was there that night through the day, and then the very next evening, I guess a 24-hour period, I was there. There was a flurry of activity in my room. There were doctors, anesthesiologists, nurses, med techs. There must have been seven or eight people in there. I couldn't believe it. They told me that I needed to be placed in a medical induced coma and put on a ventilator.
Wow.
So
what were your thoughts at that moment?
Well, I didn't really fully understand the severity of my condition. No fault of theirs. It's just I'm not a medical professional, so I didn't really realize how serious it was. I just asked him. I said, "Well, is that your recommendation?" He says, "Yes, we have to stay ahead of this." So I said, "Well, just do it then." And then things really ramped up with the activity in that room. The anesthesiologist started whatever it was that she did. I don't remember anything invasive. It was I just fell asleep.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when they put me on the ventilator.
Right. Okay. And then your waking happened when? Your next memory is from when?
Well, I was in that state for 2 days, and I don't remember any equipment in the room. I just remember being awake and seeing the nurse, a nurse or two, and a doctor, and and still feeling very, very sick. I was so sick that it was difficult for me to turn over or to roll on my side or really do much of anything. Difficulty breathing. I was receiving 6 liters of oxygen, and but I didn't feel suffocating. I was just sick, and with any effort, that's when the difficulty of breathing came in. That was after they'd removed the ventilator. And it didn't, even at that time, it didn't seem that bad. And I guess I didn't fully realize what I'd been through. I improved gradually. And they gave me several different medications. I did receive the malaria drug and zinc.
Looking back, Larry, on this experience, how close did you come to losing your life, do you feel?
Well, I didn't understand it until after I was in ICU for 9 days. And then when I got out into rehab, I started looking online. And 80% of the people that are placed on ventilators never come out. That was a real surprise. But I just felt fortunate. And the whole thing, though, was not a bad experience because I learned so much watching the medical professionals, the staff. I saw I saw unselfish act of kindness. I saw I talked to them, and that's really how I tried to pass my time, is to get to know them, and it changed my life for the better to see how they react in a stressful situation. It's wow. Impressive.
So that, I mean, I had a little bit of a start when I heard you say this was a good experience, but you're really talking about the heroic behavior and service of these frontline medical staff.
I am, yes. Yeah, the things that I learned, I came out of there a better person than I was when I went in, just by virtue of being around those people and observing how unselfish they are. They risk their lives every day. Even the housekeeping, to come in to my room at the risk of catching that, and they do it every day.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Larry, before we go, I want a little bit more about your background, because, you know, we have in our midst in Iowa, across the nation, still many people who are not taking this seriously enough. A little bit about your background. You are not a layabout. You are a fit 65-year-old, right?
Extremely fit. Let me tell you, I don't know if I think this is, well, everyone in Iowa should know what RAGBRAI is. It's the ride across Iowa they have once a year. I've done 30 of those in a row. I've ridden as much as 150 miles in one day.
Wow.
I'm an avid cyclist, extremely fit. I thought when this first came about, well, if I catch it, I catch it. It'll be like a cold, and I'll just shake it off and move on. It is not like that. If you catch it, I mean, I was so physically fit. I lost 30 pounds in the hospital in 16 days. And you want to follow the social distancing. You've got to wear a mask, wash your hands. It's very, very serious. Mm-hmm. It has changed my whole outlook.
Well, Larry Potter, thank you very much. Larry Potter of Cedar Rapids, survivor of COVID-19, the disease caused by this new coronavirus. Your life has been changed, Larry, and I have a feeling that a number of people who have heard your story have had their lives changed in some way. So we want to thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As we discussed earlier in the program, we heard in our news that some of Iowa's long-term care facilities are now experiencing a really distressing situation with COVID-19. And so facilities for seniors all over the state, all over the country, are understandably taking special precautions to limit access. You may remember I visited former Congressman Neil Smith at his retirement home in Des Moines last fall. That was a visit with Smith, who was then 99 years old. Neil Smith celebrated his 100th birthday last month. Yesterday, I called him at his retirement home to find out what life is like with this sort of isolation and to get his thoughts on the crisis. We're about a month into what we've been experiencing, this social distancing. And you at your retirement home in the Des Moines area, what is your situation now? Are you allowed to see people, to have any visitors?
No, we're not allowed to have any visitors. Haven't been for since, I think it's the 15th of March or something like that. And it's very difficult not having social opportunities. Being cooped up, it's like being in jail.
What are you doing instead? How are you coping there? You're alone in your room because you can't even go to the dining room, right?
I like to watch television. However, television, there's almost nothing on television I want to watch right now. I'm sick of hearing about the way they approach things, and it's so different than what it was when I was in Congress. So television is hard to find a program I want. And so I have read two or three books, and I do some reading. and I got a magnifying glass, so it's easier for me to read. They don't print very large.
You were first elected to Congress way back in 1958. You're Iowa's longest-serving congressman. You have had a life of experiencing so many things. You have a living memory of the Great Depression. I mean, if we compare this with the Depression, it was Roosevelt who came and invested a lot of money for those days. Of course, a lot of time, a lot of money, and we've had a lot of decades since then, and it's hard to compare the amount that was spent by the Roosevelt administration.
The amount was almost nothing, and people thought, that's a whole new way of approaching government. You know, they didn't think government could be used like that, and it's amazing how he was able to do that change from being, he was not raised that way, but he could see what had to be done, and he had some help, and they changed what they had to.
Do you think this epidemic, pandemic, economic downturn will change the way people see our government today in 2020?
I think something is big has got to change. Something big. You can't have a $20 trillion debt and pay the interest on that while you're going ahead with everything people want and pay for it. It's just difficult. I don't see how it could be done, and it sure can't be done and have a luxurious living.
On a personal level, you've been with the people at your retirement home, no doubt with family at some point in the past, and been watching the media reports. Is there anything that surprised you about this crisis in terms of people's behavior?
I don't know if it surprised me, but there are so many people who don't understand what our situation is. And part of it is this. If you're under 40 years old right now, you've probably not been in living in the United States when there's no war. And the ones over that age have been through war after war after war and accomplished so much.
Do you have fears and anxieties of your own that you're dealing with?
Destroys your enjoyment from living and with other people, you know. And there was so much that I wanted to enjoy at my age, and my family wanted me to. Instead of that, I'm not seeing any of my family.
When you look forward to, when we look forward, as we all are looking forward to the end of this pandemic, how do you see it ending? How do you see it changing us as a nation?
They will find what it migrated from, and find that they will find a way to get a vaccine, but it will be difficult.
Well, Congressman Neil Smith, we appreciate this conversation. Keep safe, be well, and I hope we can see each other in person in the not too distant future.
Much, and you're doing a great job at Iowa Public Radio. Keep it up.
And we're coming to the end of this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. What a news week it has been, and I am so glad to spend the final minutes of this hour with IPR Studio One Tracks host Tony Daner to groove us into the weekend, of course. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Ben. Good to hear your voice again.
Good to hear your voice. I'm coming to you from my basement. Where are you?
I am in my kitchen. I'm having a nice cup of coffee, and homeschool is happening in the living room. I'm spying on them right now. It looks like looks like some good learning is happening.
Okay. Let's get to some music. Last week, crazy, 80 degrees in parts of Iowa. This week, cold, 2 snowfalls. Tony, I walked through several inches of snow with my dog this morning. It was lovely, I have to say. But, you know, the weather, crazy weather, the COVID crisis, we really need to be grooved into the weekend. What do you got for us?
Yeah, is it the weekend? I have trouble keeping track anymore.
Yeah, but, good point.
Okay, I believe you. It is the weekend. All right. So with the weather and things like that, that kind of makes it difficult to pick songs because, you know, the weather affects our mood and that affects what we want to hear, right? So so naturally, I've gone with a couple of these are newer releases, one from a somewhat newer artist, one from kind of an old friend. Let's get started with Margaret Glaspie. Her second album is called Devotion. It's really good. She's a great guitar player, great singer. Kind of wears her heart on her sleeve. She's actually performed live on IPR before. This new album is really good, and this is one of the first singles from this new Margaret Glaspie album. It's called Stay With Me.
I've had nothing but trouble and bad news on the line for such a long time. The only break I get is laughing till my eyes are wet with you. You, won't you stay with me? I'll be on my best behavior when it all shakes down. Who's the clown and who's the savior? Me, you, me, you, me. Oh, here I go again, thumbing through stacks of this and that. Everything I find reminds me of you. You, won't you stay with me? I'll be on my of you. Oh, needing something makes me wonder.
Okay, Margaret Glaspie there. Stay with me. Thanks for that. We have time, running short of time. Tony, what do you got to send us out to groove us into the weekend?
M. Ward, who is back with his 11th album called Migration Stories. Really great kind of world weariness in his voice, but it just puts you right at ease. And this is kind of a rocker. It's Unreal City from M. Ward.
Wow, how apropos. Unreal City. It's an unreal world right now. Tony Dana,
really
we are
is.
Glad. We are glad you are there from your kitchen, wherever, bringing us IPR Studio One, your daily soundtrack, 7 nights a week at 7 o'clock. Thanks, Tony. Thanks for grooving
Absolutely.
Us into
Thanks,
the weekend
Ben.
And helping us out in this crisis with the great music you deliver.
Always happy to take time for great music.
Okay. Going out with M. Ward, Unreal City. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Rick Brewer, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Of course, stay safe. Have a great weekend. And thanks for joining us. And the forest started to sunken.